Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Bethea, and you know if you join us on a regular basis, you know that the slogan for this show, if there's power in numbers, then the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative LLC captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change LLC serves as an economic blueprint for renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American-owned renewable energy companies to address effects of high energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, also to utilize African-American-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects to bring down the under and unemployment of young African-American men and women locally and nationally, also to educate the African-American community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education through Black Talk Radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. This show is also brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLF HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative, and you can get more information about that initiative by logging on to our website at positivechangepc.com. That's positivechangepc.com. You can also, this show is brought to you by, every week, by the National Association of Blacks in Solar, and you can get more information on that organization by logging in to blacksolar.org. That's blacksinsolar.org. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't have a scheduled guest today, but we have some very, very exciting topics that we're going to share with you today. But before we're going to do that, we're going to sort of set the table by letting you know that that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Once again, our call-in number is 646-668-2948. You want to remember to press 1 on your phone pad after the dialing of the call-in number, because you'll be in our green room, and we want to bring you right on into our living room, and we're going to sit down and have an exchange and an intelligent discussion about the subject matter. Ladies and gentlemen, in my lead-in, I talked about educating the African-American on the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education. And we're going to be delving just into that in our show today. But first, we want to start off our show by looking into a piece of our subject matter that we didn't get to last week, as we are looking at the EV charging industry, and we're going to look at a number of topics today. We're going to look at the greenhouse. What is the greenhouse gas emission reduction fund? And we're going to look at why most car dealers still don't have electric vehicles. Look into some other issues around the EV charging industry as we address some of the things that we're talking about. So with that being said, we're going to jump right on into the video, a new video which was produced by the Evergreen Action Group explaining EPA's new clean air standards. Without further ado, we're going to jump right on into that this morning.
Biden administration today announcing auto emission standards in the U.S. We're
building the future of the electric vehicle.
It's June 29th, 1956, and the U.S. government is about to change the country forever. The reason? A $25 billion law to build a network of roads called the Interstate Highway System. The law was the brainchild of a coalition of lobbyists led by the biggest car manufacturers and oil companies.
This is the American dream, an automotive age.
Their goal is to get more Americans to buy more cars and therefore buy more gasoline to go in those cars. And it worked. In the next 20 years, the number of cars in the U.S. more than doubled. And more recently, these industries have been two of the biggest opponents of climate action. Cars have become so ubiquitous that they now produce more climate pollution than any other form of transportation. And transportation is the most climate-polluting sector of the U.S. economy. Car exhaust contains dangerous pollution that can cause heart and lung disease, asthma, and even cancer. In the United States, these health problems disproportionately affect Black people and communities of color. Let's go back to the interstate highway system. The interstate highway plan was pretty explicitly racist. The idea was to serve suburban commuters who tended to be white. But to build them, the government paved over Black neighborhoods and left the communities divided against the wishes of the people who lived there. And these communities are still dealing with the health impacts of living so close to highways.
In 1975, the Environmental Protection Agency set the first limits on air pollution from light-duty vehicles, which are cars, SUVs, and small trucks that carry passengers. And since 1975, the amount of some key pollutants has fallen by 99%. They face intense resistance from industry. General Motors even threatened to shut down production instead of reducing their pollution.
EPA structured their rules to give industry a lot of flexibility. Basically, EPA sets a limit on how much pollution a car can emit for every mile of driving. This is called a pollution standard. Carmakers can still sell cars that don't meet the standard as long as they also sell cars that exceed the standard. EPA looks at the average across a company's fleet.
Turns out, GM didn't shut down. So, what about climate pollution?
Since 2010, EPA has set standards for greenhouse gas pollution from cars to fight climate change. Again, car and oil companies tried to stop this, but the Supreme Court stepped in to require it, and EPA has released updated standards every few years since then.
That brings us to April 12th. 2023. EPA announced their newest greenhouse gas standards for light-duty vehicles. These rules will apply to cars that are sold starting in 2027.
And there's something a little different about them. With these standards, 10 years from now, two-thirds of new cars sold in the U.S. could be electric.
Instead of burning gasoline, EVs get energy from the electric grid, which produces way less climate pollution per mile. And it's only going to get better as more clean energy is added to the grid.
EPA standards have to be based on what is possible for car makers to do. And EVs make an ambitious standard possible, especially with investments from the Inflation Reduction Act.
Come on, try.
The same communities that were torn apart by highways and polluted by car traffic are some of the most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. With these standards, the Biden administration can accelerate the path to 100% clean cars and begin to turn things around.
Hey, if you're watching this before July 2023, we need your help. EPA is accepting comments on their proposed light-duty vehicle standards. Powerful industry groups with deep pockets are trying to sneak in these rules. They're working hard to protect their profits and keep business as usual at the expense of public health and the climate. We need your support to ensure that the strongest possible version of these rules makes it into law. Go to evergreenaction.com/cleancar. And tell EPA to lock in these strong standards.
Ladies and gentlemen, you were just listening to Mrs. Rachel Patterson, who is the policy analyst for Evergreen Action. I think they did a very an excellent job in this very, very short video that they produced talking about explaining EPA clean air rules. So with that being said, we're going to sort of like flip the script this morning, and we're going to sort of keep it moving here on the program. Now, as many of you know, the call-in number is 646-668-2948, and as I come on the airways every week, we talk about environmental education, and we talk about a lot of issues educating the African American about environmental education and the impact it has on the environment, and disproportionately in affecting communities of color. Last week you heard the video that dealt with the labor crimes that are going on in the Congo with the cobalt mines. Today we're going to look at the environmental destruction as we look at an article that was published in the Yale Environment 360, published at the Yale School of the Environment. Now, this particular article, Why the Rush to Mine Lithium Could Dry Up the High Andes. The demand for lithium for EV batteries is driving a mining boom in the arid Andes regions of Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, to half of the world's rare reserves. Hydrologists are warning the mines could drain vital ecosystems and deprive indigenous communities of precious water. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Dick Gregory told us years ago that the number one battle on this planet will be for water, as we have moved into a age where we all are purchasing water. My grandmother used to tell me, "There'll come a day in America where they'll be charging for gas and water." Well, we're there. When we begin to look at what environmental price should be, should the world be willing to pay for the metals needed to switch to electric vehicles? The question is being asked urgently in South America, where there are growing fears that what is good for the global climate may be a disaster for some of the world's rarest and most precious ecosystems, salt flats, wetlands, grazing pastures, and flaming high lakes in the Andes. These remote regions, which are straddling the borders between Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, has become known as the Lithium Triangle because it is a sudden focus on global rush for minerals vital in making lithium-ion batteries to decarbonize the world's automobiles. Demand for lithium is predicted to quadruple by year 2030 to 2.4 million metric tons annually, and the anticipated prices of the world markets have risen close to tenfold in the past years. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, more than half of the world's lithium reserves are dissolved in ancient underground water within the lithium triangle. Mining conglomerates are competing to grab the metals by pumping water to the surface and evaporating it in the sun. Concentrate the lithium carbonate as that it contains lithium and the lightest of all metals, soft marble with high capacity to store energy, is the ideal material to make lightweight rechargeable batteries. Demand for lithium or lithium ion batteries to power mobile devices has risen strongly for three decades, but will mobile phone batteries require just a tenth of the amount of lithium carbonate a typical electric car battery requires? 130 pounds, around 200,000 times as much. So this is what we're looking at, ladies and gentlemen, unless they're going to come up with a different technology for these batteries, which the world's car fleets transitioning to electric propulsion. Argentina, which serves as 60 million metric tons, according to the government estimates, is well positioned to profit from the lithium rush. Lax regulations and low taxes make it part of the lithium triangle. In the northwest province of Jura, salt especially attractive for foreign investors, according to Lucas Gonzaga, the National Scientific and Technical Research Council. The government agency in Buenos Aires, the country could soon become the world's second largest lithium producer, and Australia the largest producer, evaporated mining. Now, this is the process. They're pumping water in the ground. By every ton of lithium carbon extracted from the underground using the cheap, low-tech metal physical disparities, pumping them into the air, about a half a million gallons of water that is vital to the arid Andes, the extraction lower water tables, and because fresh water often sits on the top of salt water, this was the potential to dry up lakes, wetlands, springs, rivers that flourish where the underground water reaches the surface. Hydrologists and conservationists say Argentina lithium rush turned of the region's dedicated ecosystems into a desert. Meanwhile, indigenous populations in the high Andes increasingly feel the scarce water in which they rely on for domestic use as to keep alive pastures and their livestock. Depends is being sacrificed in a global drive for green vehicles to fight climate change. This is where we are, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the issues and who is this is affecting. The lithium triangle comprises a series of close basins more than 10,000 feet in the Andes. Rainwater from the surrounding mountains peaks has for thousands of years flowed into the basins, forming lakes, wetlands, salt plains, and as well accumulating underground. The water has brought with it large quantities of lithium carbonate and salt of sodium, boron, and potassium and manganese that is eroded from the mountains. The salt lands and water in the basin varies from place to place. Recently arrived fresh water, vital for wildlife and human communities, is typically found around the edge of the basins, wherever salt water is generally closer to the center, where decades of evaporations, intense high altitude, sunlight has reduced the water and concentrated lithium and other salts. Some 50 mining projects are currently licensed for underground activities. Discussion with Northwest alone. Now mining companies extend their extra lithium by extract extra lithium by dramatically accelerating the natural evaporation by pumping salt underground water from wells into vast evaporation ponds they are creating across tens of thousands of square miles of salt flats in total for a 50 projects are currently lost licensed and are active. Discussions in Northwest Argentina alone is covering acres larger than the state of Delaware. Typical after a year or so in the sun, the concentrated lithium carbonate in the water, 3.5% of the will be sent by truck for further chemical treatment and extractions of lithium. But by this time, about 500,000 gallons of water have evaporated from tons of lithium carbonate collected, calculated Victoria Fletcher, chemist who looks at these issues. Several mining companies approached to the commitment and concerns about the impact of their actions did not respond. The U.S.-based Lavent Corporation says responsible stewardship of the environment is essential to our work. We utilize a comprehensive system to manage and record environmental parametrics such as water flow, chemical transport, and of the salinity. However, many independent hydrologists are skeptical that the extraction can be achieved without the impacts of on the ecosystem and the water supply of the local communities. Hydrologists of the basin of lithium triangle is poorly understood, according to Brandon Moran of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who has a conducted detailed studies to determine the age and the source of the water. The water often lies deep underground and flows across great distances and over long periods of time. And there's a picture showing how they're pumping this water from underground and where it's going into these lakes. And the basins are usually hydraulically linked below ground for lowering the water table in one may be lower than others, according to the study. Hydrologists at the universities of Buenos Aires, the extraction of water can affect wetlands communities and in areas many times bigger than the surface area. Project said Roman, BAIGUN, program manager for saving high Andes wetlands at the Wetlands International Conservation Organization. Billions of liters of water is evaporated to return to the system. The forerunner to the future lithium mining in Argentina to solar day covering 230 miles from northern Comercia, which has been operated by Lavent since 1997 with rising demand for automakers such as BMW, Tesla. The company's recently completed a $600 million expansion that will double annual output to 40,000 tons with reserves estimated at 1.2 million 30 years, but production requires pumping about 170,000 gallons of water from underground every hour to fill its giant emerald green basins, and even bigger projects for sales de jure based started extractions in 2014, a collaboration between Australia mining companies and Japanese car makers Toyota, Mitsubishi, which has rights to its annual output of 4,500 tons at the same basins on other projects. So as you can see, ladies and gentlemen, the rush is on. And you can, and I thought about the flamingos, which that fly out into the salt, warm salt lakes in the Andes, and the impact it will have on the environment. But this is a very, very, very long, detailed article, ladies and gentlemen, which we are going, I'm not going to go through all of it, but we've hit up some of the very important parts of it. And what we're talking about is this environmental education that people have to understand and connect the dots. Now, there are other forms of technologies that they can use, but corporations are always about one thing. The bottom line, what's the cheapest way to do something rather than looking at it may cost more on the upfront side, but on the back end side, the impact, economics impacts, and the disaster to the environment won't be the same. So, as we always say, somebody's going to have to make a choice. Several mining companies approached to comment on concerns about the impact of their activities did not respond. U.S.-based Livent Corporation said reasonable stewardship for environment is essential to our work. And I just read that. So we understand what people, these corporations are going to say. They're going to say, oh, no, it's not going to hurt the environment at all, as long as they can make the bottom line, as long as they getting paid. So these are real issues, ladies and gentlemen, as we are looking at these environmental destructive practices of the way that they're using hydraulics to mine this lithium. Now, we're going to be looking at the Albemarle Corporation based in Charlotte, North Carolina, is presently investing $1.3 billion for a lithium manufacturing facility that will be in Chester, South Carolina. Since this is going to have such an impact on communities of color in those regions, let's look at and see how many CBEs will be able to get any kind of contracting opportunities with this new $1.3 billion investment that will be coming to Chester County, which is a historically black township, and I happen to know some African Americans who want to build a large-scale solar power and battery plant to become that are approaching Albemarle to look at and consider becoming off-takers for their project. So when we begin to connect the dots, how can this benefit the African-American community? Because, ladies and gentlemen, we are in the paradigm shift as it relates to manufacturing, precious minerals, and bringing the manufacturing process back to the U.S. And we're going to get into that, ladies and gentlemen, as we move through our program today. But in the meantime, you who follow us on a regular basis, you know that the Call-in number for this show is 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Please remember to press 1 on your phone pad after dialing the call-in number because you'll be in our green room and we want to bring you right on into our living room. Now, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to pause for the calls here on Solar Now with its economic impact on Black America, and we'll be right back as we try to share with you.
Life is a song worth singing. I can tell. Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. Why don't you sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand. Use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, back to the airways of Solar Now and the future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Buffet, and you know this if you join us on a regular basis. You know that call-in number is 646-668-2948. Once again, that call-in number is 646-668-2948. And please remember to press 1 on your phone pad after dialing the call-in number because you'll be in our green room and we want to bring you right on into our living room so we can sit down and you can share in on this conversation. Now, as we were just looking at the environmental destruction that the process of this hydraulic mining process for lithium is taking place, then we want to look at another encroachment on indigenous lands that we know belong to our Native American brothers and sisters. As we look at Biden moves forward with mining project that will obliterate sacred Apache religious sites. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it correctly. Biden administration attorneys were in the court this week to defend a mining project that will obliterate one of the most sacred Apache religious sites in American Southwest. In an oral argument on Tuesday, the U.S. Forest Service said it is nearing completion of environmental impact studies that will transfer land to east of Phoenix to two of the world's largest mining companies for the purpose of building one of the largest copper mines on the planet. The massive project will hinge on the destruction of the Shishili Bagoti at the plateau, otherwise known as Oak Flat. That is a sacred to many Native American tribes, particularly the San Carlos Apache, who considers the area mining them most of their most holiest of sites. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a nearly two-hour hearing, an 11-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Pasadena, California, peppered lawyers on both sides of the high-stakes legal fight with an array of complex case law questions raised by the project beginning nearly two decades ago. Battle for Oak Flat site at the intersection of the indigenous rights and of the disposition of religious liberty, public lands, and private sales, and a growing demand for so-called green energy solutions in the area of climate of a climate catastrophe. As the court is aware, this case is not about an agency's actions. It's about the act of the U.S. Congress. In the Congress considered demands on the piece of the property balance, those interests made a decision, said John Pepin, an attorney for the Forest Service, the agency that exchanged the land in the controversial deal nearly a decade ago. Oh, this sounds like one of them backroom deals. It decided on Oak Flats would be transferred to the Resolution Copper, so the third largest copper ore deposit in the world can be mined. The legislation in question in the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange and Conservation Act was the product of a proposal then Arizona Senator John McCain and Jeff Flake made to the most passed defense authorization bill late one night in 2014. The addendum known as the rider incurred no congressional debate, described by the San Clara Apache as the midnight backroom deal. The law transferred Oak Flats to the Resolution Copper, British Australian concerns jointly owned by an extra giant Reno Pinto BHP, both of which had sought access to the wild, lucrative ore deposits for years. So this battle has been going on, ladies and gentlemen. The project centers around 22,000 acres known as Oak Flat Campground, part of the Tonto National Forest, has reserves, has a centerpiece of Apache religious ceremonies, and since before settlers expanded into the West to access or underneath a Resolution Copper will use techniques known as block cave mining, which over several years will turn the Scarce Mountain into 2 miles of wide charted deep enough to hide a skyscraper. The invitation of construction hinges on the publication of an environmental impact study of the Forest Service, which under the law passed in 2014 in 60-day countdown before the transfer of the land from the federal government to the mining company. This will happen. Ladies and gentlemen, it gets deeper and deeper. A fine is about a substantial burden, but here after the government is doing something far worse, not the threatening fines, but authorizing the complete physical destruction of Oak Flats. Luke Goodrich led the attorney of the Apache stronghold of Arizona-based nonprofits that brought the lawsuit to stop the transfer, told the panel of judges that the destruction of Oak Flats was a direct flagrant violation of Religious Freedom Act. Violations of the statute requires the imposition of substantial burden on the persons of the group ability to practice their faith. A fine is a substantial burden, but there is a government that is doing something far worse, Goodrich said, not just threatening fines, but authorizing the complete physical destruction of Oak Flats, barring the Apaches from accessing again and ending their core religious exercise forever. In January of 2021, 5 days before the Office of the Administration of President Donald Trump released a study supporting creation of the Oak Flats mine, Apache Stronghold Hell filed a federal lawsuit seeking a preliminary injunction to stop the projects. Unsuccessfully in this attempt, the group failed by the emergency appeal by the Ninth Circuit Court Circuit filing 6 months, 6 hours before the deadline response passed the Forest Services. By then, March 21, under the leadership of President Joe Biden, announced that it was withdrawing the environmental impact study and posting the land up for transfer. A three-judge panel in the Ninth Court of Apache Stronghold case in other October 21, but agreed to hear the case again before the full panel last winter. The unusual decision set forth a stage for the hearing while the postponement of the project has been opponents of the mine mineral deposit long-running battle. Government testimony this week confirmed that the Biden administration moving forward with a new environmental impact study stands behind the controversial land swap. We said spring, Pippin told the panel of judges it could be shed over into the entire summer into a 60-day notice given by the coming out of near future. I do believe this case is just but while Apache Stronghold religious freedom argument has drawn support from an array of faith-based organizations from across the country, opponents in the same mind argue that the project brings in 3,700 jobs and $1 billion each year for the Arizona economy. David DeBoe, the attorney responding, Extraction Industry Associate, told the court that the win for the plaintiff in case that would extract huge and unsurmountable obstacles for the sale of the government land to private entities. Damage to property enterprise would be profound if the purchase to the federal property could only be used for property later. Through whether the federal government, DeBoe said, it is the rule that that's being argued for here. Although not in so many words, the judge took the argument into consideration. The panel has offered its indication when it will rule on the case, has offered no indication of when it will rule on the case. Should the judges again rule in favor of the mining company and the federal government, the plaintiffs are likely to take the case to the Supreme Court following the hearing. Defenders of Oak Flat gathered in the rain to the brief and prayer. Goodrich Apache Stronghold attorney said there's no disputing the core fact of this case. There is not a theoretical matter. He said this is the people matter. This is about people and their freedom and the Apache and the indigenous or indigenous American. Ladies and gentlemen, this thing here is deep because you had thousands of Native Americans who went there and chained themselves to equipment and the whole nine yards. This stuff is going to be played out in the suites, in the streets, because the folks have no choice. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is solely now and the future with this economic impact on Black America. But this solarization, moving to the so-called green economy, the poor indigenous communities and people of color, African Americans, as we see, we are the ones who are paying the price for this moving forward with our lives as well as pocketbooks. These are real pocketbook issues. And getting people to come on shows like this, they're not coming because they're not going to comment on this. Now, all this can be found where? At PositiveChangePC.com, at PositiveChangePC.com. And we're basically just ending up, clearing up some issues and matters concerning our last week's show. Now, when we want to talk about the labor crimes, we want to replay a piece that will take us to our
support for NPR and the following message comes
timeline. This is an NPA report.
To hear from SAP Concur's Mary Frances Van Velsen and customer Lindsay Ballram, who discuss how having the right data on spending can lead to policies that are better for businesses and employees who travel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our smartphones and electric vehicles, emblems of the modern world, are powered by workers in slave-like conditions, mining for cobalt in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Cobalt is an essential component of the rechargeable batteries used in devices and EVs. Electric vehicles are supposed to be a big part of the solution to lowering carbon emissions, but cobalt mining in the Congo is not only a human catastrophe, it's an environmental disaster. Congo has more reserves of cobalt than the rest of the planet combined, but there's no such thing as a clean supply chain of cobalt from the Congo, writes my guest, Siddharth Kara. He says all cobalt sourced from the Congo is tainted by various degrees of abuse, including slavery, child labor, forced labor, debt bondage, human trafficking, and incalculable environmental harm. Kara has been researching modern-day slavery, human trafficking, and child labor for over 20 years and has just published his fourth book. It's called Cobalt Red, and it's based on his trips to the Congo in 2018, 2019, and 2021. 2020 was COVID year, and that year he didn't travel there. He took great risks to go to the cobalt mines, many of which are guarded by the military or militias, which definitely don't want human rights activists snooping around. He says perceived troublemakers can be arrested, tortured, or worse. Kara is a senior fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health and an associate professor of human trafficking and modern slavery at Nottingham University in England. His book, Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, won the 2010 Frederick Douglass Book Prize, awarded for the best book written in English on slavery or abolition. Siddharth Kara, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with, why is cobalt so essential for our phones and EV batteries?
Well, cobalt is used in the manufacture of almost every single lithium-ion rechargeable battery used in the world today. So that means almost every smartphone, tablet, laptop, and crucially, electric vehicle used around the world.
So let's talk about the mines and the conditions of the adults and children who work in them. There's two kinds of mines, the industrial mines owned by big companies, and then there are the artisanal miners. So let's start with them. Artisanal sounds kind of very arts and craftsy, very boutique-y. What does artisanal mining actually mean?
Yes, that term belies the truth, the reality of the degrading conditions under which the quote-unquote artisanal miners work. You have to imagine walking around some of these mining areas and dialing back our clock centuries. People are working in subhuman, grinding, degrading conditions, and they're called artisanal miners because they use pickaxes, shovels, stretches of rebar to hack and scrounge at the earth in trenches and pits and tunnels to gather cobalt and feed it up the formal supply chain.
And they're freelancers, and they're not working for a mining company. They're more like the gold rush miners in California in the mid-1800s, except they get paid, like, next to nothing, and the conditions are horrible. So describe what these mines look like. And I should mention, according to the New York Times in 2021, 30% of the cobalt that is mined is artisanal in the Congo.
At least. And this is a really important thing to understand, Terry. You know, outside the Congo, there's this story that there are these two categories, industrial mine and artisanal mining. But down on the ground, there's no such thick dividing line. Industrial mines, almost all of them have artisanal miners digging in and around them, feeding cobalt into the formal supply chain. And outside of industrial mines where the local population digs for cobalt, all that cobalt still flows into the formal supply chain. So that's why I make this statement. There's no such thing as clean cobalt coming out of the Congo. There's complete cross-contamination between industrial excavator-derived cobalt and cobalt that's dug by women and children with their bare hands.
So describe what these artisanal mines look like.
Well, you have to imagine like a lunar landscape. The Earth has been hacked up, dug up, upturned for miles and miles in every direction. The trees are gone. The air is a suffocating, toxic haze of dust and grit. And people are in trenches, in pits, in tunnels, caked in toxic filth. Cobalt is toxic to touch and breathe. And there are hundreds of thousands of poor Congolese people touching and breathing it day in and day out. Young mothers with babies strapped to their backs, all breathing in this toxic cobalt dust. And the whole landscape has just been destroyed. Millions of trees have been clear cut by giant mining companies. The water, the earth, has been contaminated with toxic effluents from mining processing. It's hard to capture in words just how horrific the landscape is and the scene of human degradation is.
You compare these workers to modern-day slaves. You call them modern-day slaves. What is worthy of such a horrible comparison?
Imagine an entire population of people cannot survive without scrounging in hazardous conditions for a dollar or two a day. There's no alternative there. The mines have taken over everything. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced because their villages were just bulldozed over to make place for large mining concessions. So you have people with no alternative, no other source of income. Now add to that the menace in many cases of armed forces pressuring people to dig, parents having to make a painful decision, do I send my child to school or do we eat today? And if they choose the latter, that means bringing all their kids into these toxic pits to dig just to earn that extra 50 cents or a dollar a day that could mean the difference between eating or not. So in the 21st century, this is modern day slavery. It's not chattel slavery from the 18th century where you can buy and trade people and own title over a person like property. But the level of degradation, the level of exploitation is on par with old world slavery.
Besides the toxic aspect of the mining, what are some of the dangers involved in artisanal mining?
Well, I spoke with many families whose children, husbands, spouses had suffered horrific injuries. Oftentimes digging in these larger open-air pits, there are pit wall collapses. Imagine a mountain of gravel and stone just avalanching down on people, crushing legs and arms, spines. I met people whose legs had been amputated, who had metal bars where their legs used to be. And then the worst of all, Terry, is what happens in tunnel digging. There are probably 10 to 15,000 tunnels that are dug by hand by artisanal miners. None of them have supports, ventilation shafts, rock bolts, anything like that. And these tunnels collapse all the time, burying alive everyone who is down there, including children. It's a demise that is almost impossibly horrific to imagine. And yet I met mothers pounding their chests in grief, talking about their children who had been buried alive in a tunnel collapse.
So these industrial mines, they're owned by companies. The companies don't confess that the conditions are like this. So is this considered illegal, of these working conditions and the child labor? Are they considered illegal in Congo, but they happen anyways, or is there no oversight at all?
Well, technically, under the law, there should not be artisanal mining taking place in any industrial mine. And yet, lo and behold, at most of the industrial mines, there is some artisanal mining taking place. In some cases, predominantly artisanal mining taking place. And the reason is it's a penny wage way to boost production. I mean, imagine you're in a part of the world where there are millions of people who barely get a dollar or two a day. We're grindingly poor and will accept almost any labor arrangement just to survive. Well, you put them in a tight pit, cram them with 10,000 other people, and pay them a couple of dollars, and they'll produce, you know, thousands of tons of cobalt per year for almost no wages. And so that's not legal, but it's happening.
So no one knows if the cobalt that they're buying from Congo for the batteries that they're going to manufacture for our devices and electric vehicles, no one knows whether these are from unauthorized artisanal mines or from official industrial mines or authorized artisanal mines. So how is the cobalt that is not from authorized mines laundered into the larger supply chain?
No company at the top of the chain can reasonably claim that their supply of cobalt is untainted by artisanal production, child labor, forced labor, degraded labor, and so forth. And it's because of the following reality. There's this informal layer of the supply chain beneath the formal mining operations to which that artisanal cobalt is, and you use the right word, laundered into the formal supply chain. Now, as I said, there are some artisanal diggers who work inside industrial mining companies and sell production directly inside the mines. But for that artisanal cobalt that is dug in all the hundreds of sites all over that part of the Congo, there are these traders. They're called negotiants. They will buy your sack of cobalt for a dollar or two, and they will either sell it directly to a formal mining company or, more often than not, to another intermediary called buying houses or depots. And these depots aggregate large amounts of copper cobalt sacks purchased from negotiants or sometimes directly from artisanal miners. And then these depots sell tons and tons of copper cobalt by the sack load to formal mining companies. And that's how all this artisanal flow enters the formal supply chain and why nobody really knows what's industrial, what is artisanal.
Well, this also allows plausible deniability, doesn't it?
That's right. You can stand up at the top of the chain selling your phones and cars and say, well, I buy from ABC Mining Company, and ABC Mining Company has told me that this cobalt.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not making any of this up. You're hearing this here. If you haven't heard it on yesterday, you're hearing on my last week's broadcast, you're hearing it again on this week's broadcast. We are closing, ladies and gentlemen, another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. But the reason why I talked about the manufacturing aspect is because since our African-American sisters and brothers of color around throughout the diaspora and around the world, since our communities are the ones who are being forced into this type of labor force, why isn't there opportunities being we can create here on this end in the U.S. of A through getting more African Americans involved in the manufacturing and the contract businesses that help our people in those countries formalize formal businesses that they can go about dealing with this from a different perspective? There's a way this can be done. Now, we've come to the close of another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America, ladies and gentlemen. And we always say in closing, we don't want you to meet us back here. We want you to beat us back here. Now, you have to go to our website, and you want to go to our news and events tab. You want to look at our entire listing of articles that we posted for June and last month, May. You will find a treasure trove of information, grant opportunities there. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not the greedy, but we are definitely the needy when it comes for us a financial assistance to keep this podcast on the air. It is becoming an economic burden for me as the producer of this to bring this information to you every week. Many of you hear me on Carl Nelson's show on WOL 1450 AM. I have been trying to, for a number of years, raise enough money to buy airtime to syndicate this from a podcast to a national syndicated radio show. With your help, I can do that. Please go to our GoFundMe link on here on our website, positivechangepc.com, and you can contribute whatever. You understand? It will be appreciated. Once again, that's positivechangepc.com. Until next week, we don't want you to beat us back here. We want you to meet us back here, but beat us back here as we close another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And ladies and gentlemen, please remember to go in peace.
Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? Life is a song worth singing.
Why don't you
sing it? You hold a key in the palm of your hand.
Use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan.
Change it.
Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life. Life is a song worth singing.